Willem was gone. He was gone from him forever. He was never coming back. He would never see him again. He would never hear Willem's voice again. He would never smell him again. He would never feel Willem's arms around him. He would never again be able to unburden himself of one of his memories, sobbing with shame as he did. Would never again jerk awake from one of his dreams, blind with terror, to feel Willem's hand on his face, to hear Willem's voice above him. "You're safe, Judy. You're safe. It's over. It's over. It's over." And then he had cried, really cried, cried for the first time since the accident. He had cried for Willem, for how frightened he must have been, for how he must have suffered, for his poor, short life. But mostly he had cried for himself. How was he going to keep living without Willem? His entire life, his life after Brother Luke, his life after Dr. Traylor, his life after the monastery and the motel rooms and the home and the trucks, which was the only part of his life that counted, had had Willem in it. There had not been a day since he was 16 and met Willem in their room at Hood Hall in which he had not communicated with Willem in some way. Even when they were fighting, they spoke. "Jude," Harold had said, "it will get better. I swear. I swear. It won't seem like it now, but it will." They all said this. Richard and J.B. and Andy. The people who wrote him cards. Kit. Emil. All they told him was that it would get better. But although he knew enough to never say so aloud, privately he thought, "It won't." Harold had had Jacob for 5 years. He had had Willem for 34. There was no comparison. Willem had been the first person who loved him, the first person who had seen him not as an object to be used or pitied, but as something else, as a friend. He had been the second person who had always, always been kind to him. If he hadn't had Willem, he wouldn't have had any of them. He would never have been able to trust Harold if he hadn't trusted Willem first. He was unable to conceive of life without him because Willem had so defined what his life was and could be. The next day he did what he never did. He called Sanjay and told him he wasn't coming in for the next 2 days. And then he had lain in bed and cried, screaming into the pillows until he lost his voice completely. But from those last 2 days, he had found another solution. Now he stays very late at work, so late that he has seen the sun rise from his office. He does this every weekday, and on Saturdays as well. But on Sundays he sleeps as late as he can, and when he wakes, he takes a pill, one that not only makes him fall asleep again, but bludgeons into obsolescence all glimmers of wakefulness. He sleeps until the pill wears off, and then he takes a shower and gets back into bed and takes a different pill, one that makes sleep shallow and glassy, and sleeps until Monday morning. By Monday, he has not eaten in 24 hours, sometimes more, and he is trembly and thoughtless. He swims, he goes to work. If he is lucky, he has spent Sunday dreaming of Willem, for at least a little while. He has bought a long, fat pillow, as long as a man is tall, one meant to be pressed against by pregnant women or by people with back problems, and he drapes one of Willem's shirts over it and holds it as he sleeps, even though in life it was Willem who held him. He hates himself for this, but he cannot stop. He is aware, dimly, that his friends are watching him, that they are worried about him. At some point it had emerged that one of the reasons he remembers so little from the days after the accident was because he had been in the hospital, on a suicide watch. Now he stumbles through his days and wonders why he isn't in fact killing himself. This is, after all, the time to do it. No one would blame him. And yet he doesn't. At least no one tells him that he should move on. He doesn't want to move on. He doesn't want to move into something else. He wants to remain exactly at this stage forever. At least no one tells him he's in denial. Denial is what sustains him, and he is dreading the day when his delusions will lose their power to convince him. For the first time in decades, he isn't cutting himself at all. If he doesn't cut himself, he remains numb, and he needs to remain numb. He needs the world to not come too close to him. He has finally managed to achieve what Willem had always hoped for him. All it took was Willem being taken from him. In January, he had a dream that he and Willem were in the house upstate making dinner and talking, something they'd done hundreds of times. But in the dream, although he could hear his own voice, he couldn't hear Willem's. He could see his mouth moving, but he couldn't hear anything he was saying. He had woken then, and had thrown himself into his wheelchair and moved as quickly as he could into his study, where he scrolled through all of his old emails, searching and searching, until he found a few voice messages from Willem that he had forgotten to delete. The messages were brief and unrevealing, but he played them over and over, weeping, bent double with grief. The messages' very banality. "Hey, Judy, I'm going to the farmer's market to pick up those ramps, but do you want anything else? Let me know." Something precious, because it was proof of their life together.
"Willem,"
he said aloud to the apartment, because sometimes, when it was very bad, he spoke to him.
"Come back to me. Come back."
He feels no sense of survivor's guilt, but rather survivor's incomprehension. He had always, always known he would predecease Willem. They all knew it. Willem, Andy, Harold, JB, Malcolm, Julia, Richard. He would die before all of them. The only question was how he would die. It would be by his own hand, or it would be by infection. But none of them had ever thought that Willem, of all people, would die before he did. There had been no plans made for that, no contingencies. Had he known this was a possibility, had it been less absurd a concept, he would have stockpiled. He would have made recordings of Willem's voice talking to him and kept them. He would have taken more pictures. He would have tried to distill Willem's very body chemistry. He would have taken him, just woken, to the perfumer in Florence. "Here," he would have said, this scent. "I want you to bottle this." Jane had once told him that, as a girl, she had been terrified her father would die, and she had secretly made digital copies of her father's dictation. He had been a doctor as well, and stored them on flash drives. And when her father finally did die, 4 years ago, she had rediscovered them, and had sat in a room playing them, listening to her father dictating orders in his calm, patient voice. How he envied Jane this. How he wished he had thought to do the same. At least he had Willem's films, and his emails, and letters he had written him over the years, all of which he had saved. At least he had Willem's clothes, and articles about Willem, all of which he had kept. At least he had JB's paintings of Willem. At least he had photographs of Willem, hundreds of them, though he only allotted himself a certain number. He decided he would allow himself to look at 10 of them every week, and he would look and look at them for hours. It was his decision whether he wanted to review one a day or look at all 10 in a single sitting. He was terrified his computer would be destroyed and he would lose these images. He made multiple copies of the photographs and stored the discs in various places, in his safe at Green Street, in his safe at Lantern House, in his desk at Rosen Pritchard, in his safe deposit box at the bank. He had never considered Willem a thorough cataloger of his own life. He isn't either. But one Sunday in early March, he skips his drugged slumber and instead drives to Garrison. He has only been to the house twice since that September day, but the gardeners still come, and the bulbs are beginning to bud around the driveway, and when he steps inside, there is a vase of cut plum branches on the kitchen counter, and he stops, staring at them. Had he texted the housekeeper to tell her he was coming? He must have. But for a moment, he fancies that at the beginning of every week, someone comes and places a new arrangement of flowers on the counter, and at the end of every week, another week in which no one comes to see them, they are thrown away. He goes to his study, where they had installed extra cabinetry so Willem could store his files and paperwork there as well. He sits on the floor, shrugging off his coat, then takes a breath and opens the first drawer. Here are file folders, each labeled with the name of a play or movie, and inside each folder is the shooting version of the script with Willem's notes on them. Sometimes there are call sheets from days when an actor he knew Willem particularly admired was going to be filming with him. He remembers how excited Willem had been on the Sycamore Court, how he had sent him a photo of that day's call sheet with his name typed directly beneath Clark Butterfield's. "Can you believe it?" his message had read. "I can totally believe it," he'd written back. He flips through these files, lifting them out at random and carefully sorting through their contents. The next three drawers are all the same things: films, plays, other projects. In the fifth drawer is a file marked Wyoming, and in this are mostly photos, most of which he has seen before. Pictures of Hemming, pictures of Willem with Hemming, pictures of their parents, pictures of the siblings Willem never knew, Britta and Axel. There is a separate envelope with a dozen pictures of just Willem, only Willem, school photos, and Willem in a Boy Scout uniform, and Willem in a football uniform. He stares at these pictures, his hands in fists, before placing them back in their envelope. There are a few other things in the Wyoming file as well. A third-grade book report, written in Willem's careful cursive, on the Wizard of Oz that makes him smile. A hand-drawn birthday card to Hemming that makes him want to cry. His mother's death announcement, his father's, a copy of their will. A few letters from him to his parents, from his parents to him, all in Swedish. These he sets aside to have translated. He knows Willem had never kept a journal, and yet when he looks through the Boston file, he thinks for some reason he might find something. But there is nothing. Instead, there are more pictures, all of which he has seen before, of Willem, so shiningly handsome, of Malcolm looking suspicious and slightly feral, with the stringy, unsuccessful afro he had tried to cultivate throughout college, of J.B. looking essentially the same as he does now, merry and fat-cheeked, of him looking scared and drowned and very skinny, in his awful too-big clothes and with his awful too-long hair, in his braces that imprisoned his legs in their black, foamy embrace. He stops at a picture of the two of them sitting on the sofa in their suite in Hood, Willem leaning into him and looking at him, smiling, clearly saying something, and him laughing with his hand over his mouth, which he had learned to do after the counselors at the home told him he had an ugly smile. They look like two different creatures, not just two different people, and he has to quickly refile the picture before he tears it in half. Now it is becoming difficult to breathe, but he keeps going. In the Boston file, in the New Haven file, are reviews from the college newspapers of plays Willem had been in. There is the story about J.B.'s Lee Lozano-inspired performance art piece. There is, touchingly, the one calculus exam on which Willem had made a B, an exam he had coached him on for months. And then he reaches into the drawer again, most of which is occupied not by a hanging file, but by a large, accordion-shaped one, the kind they use at the firm. He hefts it out and sees that it is marked only with his name, and slowly opens it. Inside it is everything. Every letter he had ever written Willem, every substantial email printed out. There are birthday cards he'd given Willem. There are photographs of him, some of which he has never seen. There is the Art Forum issue with Jude with cigarette on the cover. There is a card from Harold written shortly after the adoption, thanking Willem for coming and for the gift. There is an article about him winning a prize in law school, which he certainly hadn't sent Willem, but someone clearly had. He hadn't needed to catalog his life after all. Willem had been doing it for him all along. But why had Willem cared about him so much? Why had he wanted to spend so much time around him? He had never been able to understand this, and now he never will. I sometimes think I care more about your being alive than you do, he remembers Willem saying, and he takes a long, shuddering breath. On and on it goes, this detailing of his life, and when he looks in the sixth drawer, there is another accordion file, the same as the first, marked Jude 2, and behind it, Jude 3, and Jude 4. But by this point he can no longer look. He gently replaces the files, closes the drawers, relocks the cabinets. He puts Willem's and his parents' letters into an envelope, and then another envelope for protection. He removes the plum branches, wraps their cut ends in a plastic bag, dumps the water from the vase into the sink, locks up the house, and drives home, the branches on the seat next to him. Before he goes up to his apartment, he lets himself into Richard's studio, fills one of the empty coffee cans with water, and inserts the branches, leaves it on his work table for him to find in the morning. Then it is the end of March. He is at the office. A Friday night, or rather, a Saturday morning, he turns away from his computer and looks out the window. He has a clear view to the Hudson, and above the river he can see the sky turning white. For a long time he stands and stares at the dirty gray river, at the wheeling flocks of birds. He returns to his work. He can feel, these past few months, that he has changed, that people are frightened of him. He has never been a jolly presence in the office, but now he can tell he is mirthless. He can feel he has become more ruthless. He can feel he's become chillier. He and Sanjay used to have lunch together, the two of them griping about their colleagues, but now he cannot talk to anyone. He brings in business. He does his job. He does more than he needs to, but he can tell no one enjoys being around him. He needs Rosen Pritchard. He would be lost without his work, but he no longer derives any pleasure from it. That's all right, he tries to tell himself. Work is not for pleasure, not for most people. But it had been for him once, and now it no longer is. 2 years ago, when he was healing from his surgery, and so tired that Willem had to lift him in and out of bed, he and Willem had been talking one morning. It must have been cold outside because he remembers feeling warm and safe and hearing himself say, I wish I could just lie here forever. Then do, Willem had said. This was one of their regular exchanges. His alarm would sound and he would get up. Don't go, Willem would always say. Why do you need to get up anyway? Where are you always rushing off to? I can't, he said, smiling. Listen, Willem had said, why don't you just quit your job? He had laughed. I can't quit my job, he said. Why not? Willem had asked. Besides total lack of intellectual stimulation and the prospect of having me as your sole company, give me one good reason. He had smiled again. Then there is no good reason, he said. Because I think I'd like having you as my sole company. But what would I do all day as a kept man? Cook, Willem said. Read, play the piano, volunteer, travel around with me, listen to me complain about other actors I hate, get facials, sing to me, feed me a constant stream of approbations. He had laughed, and Willem had laughed with him. But now he thinks, why didn't I quit? Why did I let Willem go far away from me for all those months, for all those years, when I could have been traveling with him? Why have I spent more hours at Rosen Pritchard than I spent with Willem? But now the choice has been made for him, and Rosen Pritchard is all he has. Then he thinks, why did I never give Willem what I should have? Why did I make him go elsewhere for sex? Why couldn't I have been braver? Why couldn't I have done my duty? Why did he stay with me anyway? He goes back to Green Street to shower and sleep for a few hours. He will return to the office that afternoon. As he rides home, his eyes lowered against the life after death posters, he looks at his messages. Andy, Richard, Harold, Black Henry Young. The last message is from JB, who calls or texts him at least twice a week. He does not know why, but he cannot tolerate seeing JB. He, in fact, hates him more purely than he has hated anyone in a long time. He is fully aware of how irrational this is. He is fully aware that JB is not to blame, not in the slightest. The hatred makes no sense. JB wasn't even in the car that day. In no way, even in the most deformed logic, does he bear any responsibility. And yet the first time he saw JB in his conscious state, he heard a voice in his head say, clearly and calmly, "It should have been you, JB." He didn't say it, but his face must have betrayed something, because JB had been stepping forward to hug him when suddenly he stopped. He has seen JB only twice since then, both times in Richard's company, and both times he has had to keep himself from saying something malignant, something unforgivable. And still JB calls him, and always leaves messages, and his messages are always the same. "Hey, Judy, it's me. I'm just checking in on you. I've been thinking about you a lot. I'd like to see you. Okay. Love you. Bye." And as he always does, he will write back to JB the same message. "Hi, JB. Thanks for your message. I'm sorry I've been so out of touch. It's been really busy at work. I'll talk to you soon. Love, Jay." But despite this message, he has no intention of talking to JB, perhaps not ever again. There is something very wrong with this world, he thinks. A world in which, of the four of them, him, JB, Willem, and Malcolm, the two best people, the two kindest and most thoughtful, have died. And the two poorer examples of humanity have survived. At least JB is talented. He deserves to live. But he can think of no reason why he might. "We're all we have left, Jude," JB had said to him at some point. "At least we have each other." And he had thought, in another of those statements that leapt quickly to mind, but that he successfully prevented himself from voicing, "I would trade you for him." He would have traded any of them for Willem. JB instantly. Richard and Andy. Poor Richard and Andy, who did everything for him. Instantly. Julia, even. Harold. He would have exchanged any of them, all of them, to have Willem back. He thinks of Hades, with his shiny Italian brawn, swooning E around the underworld. "I have a proposition for you," he says to Hades. "Five souls for one. How can you refuse?" One Sunday in April he is sleeping when he hears a banging, loud and insistent, and he wakes, groggily, and then turns onto his side, holding the pillow over his head and keeping his eyes closed, and eventually the banging stops. So when he feels someone touch him gently on his arm, he shouts and flops over and sees it is Richard, sitting next to him. "I'm sorry, Jude," says Richard. And then, "Have you been sleeping all day?" He swallows, sits up halfway. On Sundays he keeps all the shades lowered, all the curtains drawn. He can never tell, really, whether it is night or day. "Yes," he says. "I'm tired." "Well," says Richard, after a silence. I'm sorry to barge in like this, but you weren't answering your phone, and I wanted you to come downstairs and have dinner with me.
Oh, Richard, I don't know, he says, trying to think of an excuse.
Richard is right. He turns off his phone, all phones, for his Sunday cocooning, so nothing will interrupt his slumber, his attempts to find Willem in his dreams.
I'm not feeling that great. I'm not going to be good company.
I'm not expecting entertainment, Jude, Richard says, and smiles at him a bit. Come on, you have to eat something. It's just going to be you and me. India's upstate at her friend's this weekend. They are both quiet for a long time. He looks about the room, his messy bed. The air smells close, of sandalwood and steam heat from the radiator. Come on, Jude, Richard says, in a low voice. Come have dinner with me.
Okay, he says at last. Okay. Okay,
Richard says, standing. I'll see you downstairs in half an hour. He showers, and then down he goes, with a bottle of Tempranillo he remembers that Richard likes. In the apartment, he is waved away from the kitchen, and so he sits at the long table that dominates the space, which can and has sat 24, and strokes Richard's cat, Mustache, which has jumped into his lap. He remembers the first time he saw this apartment with its dangling chandeliers and its large beeswax sculptures. Over the years, it has become more domesticated, but it is still indisputably Richard's, with its palette of bone white and wax yellow. Although now India's paintings, bright, violent abstractions of female nudes, hang on the walls, and there are carpets on the floor. It has been months since he's been inside this apartment, where he used to visit at least once a week. He still sees Richard, of course, but only in passing. Mostly he tries to avoid him, and when Richard calls him to have dinner or asks to stop by, he always says he is too busy, too tired. I couldn't remember how you felt about my famous seitan stir-fry, so I actually got scallops, Richard says, and places a dish before him.
I like your famous stir-fry, he says, although he can't remember what it is and if he likes it or not. Thank you, Richard.
Richard pours them both a glass of wine and then holds his up.
Happy birthday, Jude, he says, solemnly, and he realizes that Richard is right.
Today is his birthday. Harold has been calling and emailing him all this week with a frequency that is unusual even for him, and except for the most cursory of replies, he has not spoken to him at all. He knows Harold will be worried about him. There have been more texts from Andy as well, and from some other people, and now he knows why. And he begins to cry. From everyone's kindness, which he has repaid so poorly, from his loneliness, from the proof that life has, despite his efforts to let it, gone on after all. He is 51, and Willem has been dead for 8 months. Richard doesn't say anything, just sits next to him on the bench and holds him.
I know this isn't going to help, he says at last, but I love you too, Jude.
He shakes his head, unable to speak. In recent years, he has gone from being embarrassed about crying at all to crying constantly to himself, to crying around Willem, to now, in the final falling away of his dignity, crying in front of anyone, at any time, over anything. He leans against Richard's chest and sobs into his shirt. Richard is another person whose unstinting, unwavering friendship and compassion for him has always perplexed him. He knows that some of Richard's feelings for him are twined with his feelings for Willem, and this he understands. He had made Willem a promise, and Richard is serious about his obligations. But there is something about Richard's steadiness, his complete reliability that, coupled with his height, his very size, makes him think of him as some sort of massive tree god, an oak come into human form, something solid and ancient and indestructible. Theirs is not a chatty relationship, but it is Richard who has become the friend of his adulthood, who has become, in a way, not just a friend, but a parent, although he is only 4 years older. A brother, then. Someone whose dependability and sense of decency are inviolable. Finally, he is able to stop and apologize. And after he cleans himself up in the bathroom, they eat, slowly, drinking the wine, talking about Richard's work. At the end of the meal, Richard returns from the kitchen with a lumpy little cake into which he has thrust 6 candles. 5 plus 1, Richard explains. He makes himself smile, then. He blows out the candles. Richard cuts them both slices. The cake is crumbly and figgy, more scone than cake, and they both eat their pieces in silence. He stands to help Richard with the dishes, but when Richard tells him to go upstairs, he is relieved, because he's exhausted. This is the most socializing he has done since Thanksgiving. At the door, Richard hands him something, a package wrapped in brown paper, and then hugs him. "He wouldn't want you to be unhappy, Judy," he says, and he nods against Richard's cheek. "He would hate seeing you like this." "I know," he says. "And do me a favor," Richard says, still holding him. "Call JB, okay? I know it's difficult for you, but he loved Willem too, you know. Not like you, I know, but still. And Malcolm, he misses him." "I know," he repeats, tears coming to his eyes once more. "I know." "Come back next Sunday," Richard says, and kisses him. "Or any day, really. I miss seeing you." "I will," he says. "Richard, thank you. Happy birthday, Jude." He takes the elevator upstairs. It's suddenly grown late. Back in his apartment, he goes to his study, sits on the sofa. There is a box that he hasn't opened that was messengered over to him from Flora weeks ago. Inside it are Malcolm's bequests to him and to Willem, which are now also his. The only thing Willem's death has helped with is blunting the shock, the horror of Malcolm's, and still he has been unable to open the box. But now he will. First, though, he unwraps Richard's present and sees that it is a small bust carved from wood and mounted on a heavy black iron cube of Willem, and he gasps as if slugged. Richard has always claimed that he's terrible with figurative sculpture, but he knows he's not, and this piece is proof of it. He glides his fingers over Willem's sightless eyes, across Willem's crest of hair, and after doing so, lifts them to his nose and smells sandalwood. On the bottom of the base is etched, "To J on his 51st. With love, R." He starts to cry again. Stops. He places the bust on the cushion next to him and opens the box. At first he sees nothing but wads of newspaper, and he gropes carefully inside until his hands close on something solid, which he lifts out. It is the scale model of Lantern House, its walls rendered from boxwood, that had once sat in Belcast's offices, along with the scale models of every other project the firm had ever built, in form or in reality. The model is about 2 feet square, and he settles it on his lap before holding it to his face, looking through its thin plexiglass windows, hoisting the roof up, and walking his fingers through its rooms. He wipes his eyes and reaches into the box again. The next thing he retrieves is an envelope fat with pictures of them, the four of them, or just of him and Willem, from college, from New York, from Truro, from Cambridge, from Garrison, from India, from France, from Iceland, from Ethiopia, places they'd lived, trips they'd taken. The box isn't very large, and still he removes things, two delicate, rare books of drawings of Japanese houses by a French illustrator, a small abstract painting by a young British artist he'd always admired, a larger drawing of a man's face by a well-known American painter that Willem had always liked, two of Malcolm's earliest sketchbooks, filled with page after page of his imaginary structures. And finally, he lifts the last thing from the box, something wrapped in layers of newspaper, which he removes slowly. Here, in his hands, is Lispenaert Street, their apartment, with its odd proportions and slapdash second bedroom, its narrow hallways and miniature kitchen. He can tell that this is an early piece of Malcolm's because the windows are made of glassine, not vellum or plexiglass, and the walls are made of cardboard, not wood. And in this apartment, Malcolm has placed furniture, cut and folded from stiff paper, his lumpy twin futon bed on its cinder block base, the broken springed couch they had found on the street, the squeaking wheeled easy chair given them by JB's aunts. All that is missing is a paper him, a paper Willem. He puts Lispenaert Street on the floor by his feet. For a long time he sits very still, his eyes closed, allowing his mind to reach back and wander. There is much he doesn't romanticize about those years, not now. But at the time, when he hadn't known what to hope for, he hadn't known that life could be better than Lispenaert Street. What if we'd never left? Willem would occasionally ask him. What if I had never made it? What if you'd stayed at the U.S. Attorney's office? What if I was still working in Ortolan? What would our lives be like now? How theoretical do you want to get here, Willem? He'd ask him, smiling. Would we be together? Of course we'd be together, Willem would say. That part would be the same. Well, he'd say, then the first thing we'd do is tear down that wall and reclaim the living room. And the second thing we'd do is get a decent bed. Willem would laugh. And we'd sue the landlord to get a working elevator once and for all. Right, that'd be the next step. He sits, waiting for his breathing to return to normal. Then he turns on his phone, checks his missed calls. Andy, JB, Richard, Harold and Julia, Black Henry Young, Rhodes, Citizen, Andy again, Richard again, Lucian, Asian Henry Young, Phaedra, Elijah, Harold again, Julia again, Harold, Richard, JB, JB, JB. He calls JB. It's late, but JB stays up late. Hi, he says, when JB picks up, hears the surprise in his voice. It's me. Is this a good time to talk? Chapter 2. At least one Saturday a month now, he takes half a day off from work and goes to the Upper East Side. When he leaves Green Street, the neighborhood's boutiques and stores haven't yet opened for the day. When he returns, they are closed for the night. On these days, he can imagine the Soho Harold knew as a child, a place shuttered and unpeopled, a place without life. His first stop is the building on Park and 78th, where he takes the elevator to the 6th floor. The maid lets him into the apartment, and he follows her to the back study, which is sunny and large, and where Lucian is waiting. Not waiting for him, necessarily, but waiting. There is always a late breakfast laid out for him. Thin wedges of smoked salmon and tiny buckwheat pancakes one time, a cake glazed white with lemon icing the next. He can never bring himself to eat anything, although sometimes when he is feeling especially helpless, he accepts a slice of cake from the maid and holds the plate in his lap for the entire visit. But although he doesn't eat anything, he does drink cup after cup of tea, which is always steeped exactly how he likes it. Lucian eats nothing either. He has been fed earlier. Nor does he drink. Now he goes to Lucian and takes his hand. "Hi, Lucian," he tells him. He had been in London when Lucian's wife, Meredith, called him. It was the week of Bergeson's retrospective at MoMA, and he had arranged to be out of the city on business. Lucian had had a massive stroke, Meredith said. He would live, but the doctors didn't yet know how great the damage would be. Lucian was in the hospital for 2 weeks, and when he was released, it was clear that his impairment was severe. And although it is not yet 5 months later, it has remained so. The features on the left side of his face seem to be melting off of him, and he cannot use his left arm or leg either. He can still speak, remarkably well, but his memory has vanished, the past 20 years deserting him completely. In early July, he fell and hit his head and was in a coma. Now he is too unsteady to even walk, and Meredith has moved them back from their house in Connecticut to their apartment in the city, where they can be closer to the hospital and their daughters. He thinks Lucian likes, or at least doesn't mind, his visits, but he doesn't know this for sure. Certainly Lucian doesn't know who he is. He is someone who appears in his life and then disappears, and every time he must reintroduce himself. "Who are you?" Lucian asks. "Jude," he says. "Now remind me," Lucian says, pleasantly, as if they're meeting at a cocktail party. "How do I know you?" "You were my mentor," he tells him. "Ah," says Lucian. And then there is a silence. In the first weeks, he tried to make Lucian remember his own life. He talked about Rose and Pritchard, and about people they knew, and cases they used to argue about. But then he realized that the expression he had mistaken, in his own stupid hopefulness, for thoughtfulness, was in reality fear. And so now he discusses nothing from the past, or nothing from their past together, at least. He lets Lucian direct the conversation, and although he doesn't understand the references Lucian makes, he smiles and tries to pretend he does. "Who are you?" Lucian asks. "Jude," he says. "Now tell me, how do I know you?" "You were my mentor." "Oh, at Groton?" "Yes," he says, trying to smile back. "At Groton." Sometimes, though, Lucian looks at him. "Mentor," he says. "I'm too young to be your mentor." Or sometimes he doesn't ask at all, simply begins a conversation in its middle, and he has to wait until he has enough clues and can determine what role he has been assigned, one of his daughter's long-ago boyfriends, or a college classmate, or a friend at the country club, before he can respond appropriately. In these hours, he learns more about Lucian's earlier life than Lucian had ever revealed to him before. Although Lucian is no longer Lucian, at least not the Lucian he knew. This Lucian is vague and featureless. He is as smooth and cornerless as an egg. Even his voice, that droll, croaking roll with which Lucian used to deliver his sentences, each one a statement, the pause he used to leave between them because he had grown so used to people's laughter, the particular way he had of structuring his paragraphs, beginning and ending each with a joke that wasn't really a joke, but an insult cloaked in a silken cape, is different. Even when they were working together, he knew that the Lucian of the office was not the Lucian of the country club, but he never saw that other Lucian. And now, finally, he has. He does. It is the only person he sees. This Lucian talks about the weather and golf and sailing and taxes, but the tax laws he discusses are from 20 years ago. He never asks him anything about himself, who he is, what he does, why he is sometimes in a wheelchair. Lucian talks, and he smiles and nods back at him, wrapping his hands around his cooling cup of tea. When Lucian's hands tremble, he takes them in his own, which he knows helps him when his hands shake. Willem used to do this, and breathe with him, and it would always calm him. When Lucian drools, He takes the edge of his napkin and blots the saliva away. Unlike him, however, Lucian doesn't seem embarrassed by his own shaking and drooling, and he is relieved that he doesn't. He's not embarrassed for Lucian either, but he is embarrassed by his inability to do more for him. He loves seeing you, Jude, Meredith always says, but he doesn't think this is true, really. He sometimes thinks he continues to come more for Meredith's sake than for Lucian's, and he realizes that this is the way it is, the way it must be. You don't visit the lost. You visit the people who search for the lost. Lucian is not conscious of this, but he can remember being so when he was sick, both the first time and the second, and Willem was taking care of him. How grateful he was when he would wake and find someone other than Willem sitting next to him. Roman's with him, Richard or Malcolm would say, or he and JB went out for lunch, and he'd relax. In the weeks after his amputations, when all he wanted to do was give up, those moments in which he could imagine that Willem might be being comforted were his only moments of happiness. And so he sits with Meredith after sitting with Lucian, and they talk, although she too asks him nothing about his life, and this is fine with him. She is lonely. He is lonely too. She and Lucian have two daughters, one of whom lives in New York, but is forever going in and out of rehab. The other lives in Philadelphia with her husband and three children, and is a lawyer herself. He has met both of these daughters, who are a decade or so younger than he is, although Lucian is Harold's age. When he went to visit Lucian in the hospital, the older of them, the one who lives in New York, had looked at him with such hatred that he had almost stepped back, and then had said to her sister, "Oh, and look who it is. Daddy's pet. What a surprise." "Grow up, Portia," the younger one had hissed. To him, she said, "Jude, thanks for coming. I'm so sorry about Willem." "Thank you for coming, Jude," Meredith says now, kissing him goodbye. "I'll see you soon?" She always asks this, as if he might someday tell her she won't. "Yes," he says. "I'll email you." "Do," she says, and waves as he walks down the hall toward the elevator. He always has the sense that no one else visits, and yet how can that be? "Don't let that be," he pleads. Meredith and Lucian have always had lots of friends. They threw dinner parties. It wasn't unusual to see Lucian leaving the offices in black tie, rolling his eyes as he waved goodbye to him. "Benefit," he'd say as an explanation. "Party. Wedding. Dinner." After these visits, he is always exhausted, but still he walks 7 blocks south and a quarter of a block east to the Irvines. For months he had avoided the Irvines, and then last month, on the one-year anniversary, they had asked him and Richard and JB to dinner at their house, and he knew he would have to go. It was the weekend after Labor Day. The previous 4 weeks, 4 weeks that had included the day Willem would have turned 53, the day that Willem had died, had been some of the worst he had ever experienced. He had known they would be bad. He had tried to plan accordingly. The firm had needed someone to go to Beijing, and although he knew he should have stayed in New York, he was working on a case that needed him more than the business in Beijing did. He volunteered anyway, and off he went. At first he had hoped he might be safe. The woolly numbness of jet lag was sometimes indistinguishable from the woolly numbness of his grief, and there were other things that were so physically uncomfortable, including the heat, which was woolly itself, woolly and sodden, that he had thought he would be able to distract himself. But then one night, near the end of the trip, he was being driven back to the hotel room from a long day of meetings, and he had looked out of the car window and had seen, glittering over the road, a massive billboard of Willem's face. It was a beer ad that Willem had shot 2 years ago, one that was only displayed throughout East Asia. but hanging from the top of the billboard were people on pulleys, and he realized that they were painting over the ad, that they were erasing Willem's face. Suddenly his breath left him, and he had almost asked the driver to stop, but he wouldn't have been able to. They were on a loop of road, one with no exits or places to pull over, and so he'd had to sit very still, his heart erupting within him, counting the beats it took to reach the hotel, thank the driver, get out, walk through the lobby, ride the elevator, walk down the hallway, and enter his room, where, before he could think, he was throwing himself against the cold marble wall of the shower, his mouth open and his eyes shut, tossing and tossing himself until he was in so much pain that his every vertebrae felt as if it had been jolted out of its sockets. That night he cut himself wildly, uncontrollably, and when he was shaking too badly to continue, he waited and cleaned the floor and drank some juice to give himself some energy, and then started again. After 3 rounds of this, he crept to the corner of the shower stall and wept, folding his arms over his head, making his hair tacky with blood, and that night he slept there, covered with a towel instead of a blanket. He had done this sometimes when he was a child, and had felt like he was exploding, separating from himself like a dying star, and would feel the need to tuck himself into the smallest space he could find so his very bones would stay knit together. Then he would carefully work himself out from beneath Brother Luke and bawl himself on the filthy motel carpet under the bed, which was prickly with burrs and dropped thumbtacks and slimy with used condoms and strange damp spots. Or he would sleep in the bathtub or in the closet, beetled up as tight as he was able. "My poor potato bug," Brother Luke would say when he found him like this. "Why are you doing this, Jude?" He had been gentle and worried, but he had never been able to explain it. Somehow he made it through that trip. Somehow he had made it through a year. The night of Willem's death, he dreamed of glass vases imploding, of Willem's body being projected through the air, of his face shattering against the tree. He woke missing Willem so profoundly that he felt he was going blind. The day after he returned home, he saw the first of the posters for The Happy Years, which had reverted to its original title, The Dancer and the Stage. Some of these posters were of Willem's face, his hair longish like Nureyev's, and his top scooped low on his chest, his neck long and powerful. And some were of just monumental images of a foot, Willem's actual foot, he happened to know, in a toe shoe, en pointe, shot so close you could see its veins and hairs, its thin, straining muscles and fat, bulging tendons. "Opening Thanksgiving Day," the posters read. "Oh, God," he thought, and had gone back inside. Oh, God. He wanted the reminders to stop. He dreaded the day when they would. In recent weeks, he'd had the sense that Willem was receding from him, even as his grief refused to diminish in intensity. The next week, they went to the Irvines. They had decided, in some unspoken way, that they should go up together, and they met at Richard's apartment, and he gave Richard the keys to the car, and Richard drove them. They were all silent, even J.B., and he was very nervous. He had the sense that the Irvines were angry at him. He had the sense he deserved their anger. Dinner was all of Malcolm's favorite foods, and as they ate, he could feel Mr. Irvine staring at him and wondered whether he was thinking what he himself always thought. Why Malcolm? Why not him? Mrs. Irvine had suggested that they all go around the table and share a memory of Malcolm, and he had sat, listening to the others, Mrs. Irvine, who had told a story about how they had been visiting the Pantheon when Malcolm was 6, and how, 5 minutes after they had left, they had realized that Malcolm was missing, and had rushed back to find him sitting on the ground, gazing and gazing at the oculus. Flora, who told a story about how, as a second grader, Malcolm had appropriated her dollhouse from the attic, removed all the dolls, and filled it with little objects, dozens of chairs and tables and sofas, and even pieces of furniture that had no name, that he had made with clay. J.B., the story of how they had all returned to Hood one Thanksgiving, a day early, and had broken into the dormitory so they could have it to themselves, and how Malcolm had built a fire in the living room's fireplace so they could roast sausages for dinner. And when it was his turn, he told the story of how, back at Lispenard Street, Malcolm had built them a set of bookcases, which had partitioned their squish of a living room into such a meager sliver that when you were sitting on the sofa and stretched your legs out, you stretched them into the bookcase itself. But he had wanted the shelves, and Willem had said he could. And so over Malcolm had come with the cheapest wood possible, leftovers from the lumberyard, and he and Willem had taken the wood to the roof and assembled the bookcase there so the neighbors wouldn't complain about the banging, and then they had brought it back down and installed it. But when they did, Malcolm had realized that he'd mismeasured, and the bookcases were 3 inches too wide, which caused the edge of the unit to jut into the hallway. He hadn't minded, and neither had Willem, but Malcolm had wanted to fix it. "Don't, Mal," they had both told him. "It's great, it's fine." "It's not great," Malcolm had said, mopily. "It's not fine." Finally, they had managed to convince him, and Malcolm had left. He and Willem painted the case a bright vermilion and loaded it with their books. And then, early the next Sunday, Malcolm appeared again, looking determined. "I can't stop thinking about this," he said. And he'd set his bag down on the floor and drawn out a hacksaw and had started gnawing away at the structure, the two of them shouting at him until they realized that he was going to alter it whether they helped him or not. So back up to the roof went the bookcase, back down, once again it came, and this time it was perfect. "I always think of that incident," he said, as the others listened, "because it says so much about how seriously Malcolm took his work, and how he always strove to be perfect in it, to respect the material, whether it was marble or plywood. But I also think it says so much about how much he respected space, any space, even a horrible, unfixable, depressing apartment in Chinatown. Even that space deserved respect. And it says so much about how much he respected his friends, how much he wanted us all to live somewhere he imagined for us, someplace as beautiful and vivid as his imaginary houses were to him." He stopped. What he wanted to say, but what he didn't think he could get through, was what he had overheard Malcolm say as Willem was complaining about hefting the bookcase back into place, and he was in the bathroom gathering the brushes and paint from beneath the sink.
"If I had left it like it was, he could have tripped against it and fallen, Willem," Malcolm had whispered. "Would you want that?"
"No," Willem had said, after a pause, sounding ashamed. "No, of course not. You're right, Mal." Malcolm, he realized, had been the first among them to recognize that he was disabled. Malcolm had known this even before he did. He had always been conscious of it, but he had never made him feel self-conscious. Malcolm had sought only to make his life easier, and he had once resented him for this. As they were leaving for the night, Mr. Irvine put his hand on his shoulder. "Jude, will you stay behind for a bit?" he asked. "I'll have Monroe drive you home." He had to agree, and so he did, telling Richard he could take the car back to Green Street. For a while they sat in the living room, just he and Mr. Irvine. Malcolm's mother remained in the dining room with Flora and her husband and children, talking about his health and Mr. Irvine's health, and Harold, and his work, when Mr. Irvine began to cry. He had stood then, and had sat down again.